Well, good morning. This is Per Fagreng, and our guest is Chip Ward. He's an environmental activist, author of Canaries on the Rim and Hope's Horizon, and he recently wrote an article for the Tom Dispatch called Too Big to Fail. So, Chip Ward, welcome to KBOO. Whoops. Well, while we're trying to get Chip, I will make a brief announcement. Tonight at the Unitarian Church, Reese Ehrlich will be speaking. That's at 7 p.m. Doors open at 6:30. That's at the Unitarian Church, the Elliott Chapel, which is on Southwest 12th Avenue and Main, I believe, or Salmon. And he's going to speak on Obama's foreign policy in the Middle East and Cuba. It should be really good. He's a very entertaining guy, very knowledgeable guy. Tomorrow he'll be in Hood River, then he goes to Eugene, and then Corvallis, and then back to Eugene. So he is in the state, but tonight he will be in Portland at the Unitarian Church. So anyway, hoping we we'll get Chip Ward back on the line. He wrote this very interesting article in the Tom Dispatch, which is it's called Too Big to Fail. And his point is that in nature, nothing is too big to fail. In fact, big is bound to fail. It's destined to fail. And that is an idea that we will be exploring momentarily. Okay, Chip, welcome to KBOO.
Hi, how are you?
Well, pretty good. You know, it's very interesting that there's a cartoon in today's Oregonian, the non sequitur cartoon, and it shows this guy panhandling on the street. Well, he's so huge that all you can see are his feet and a little bit of his leg, and then he kind of rises up out of the picture. And he's got a sign that says, help me out and no one gets stepped on.
Well, I think that's a scenario we're all familiar with now.
Yeah, you know, we're being blackmailed, I think, aren't we?
Yeah, yep.
So in your article in the Tom Dispatch, you say that in nature, nothing is too big to fail. In fact, big is bound to fail. Let's go into that a little bit.
Well, in the article, I'm trying to take an ecological concept, a complex adaptive cycle that really is pretty complex and is very variable, and there are exceptions. But for the most part, what we find is that an economy, like an ecosystem or any large organization, tends to go through phases. And as I say, there's quite a bit of variability in how they do it, but logically enough, you begin with a growth phase. And in that growth phase, there's lots of opportunity and lots of partnerships to be made, paths to take, all sorts of potential. If you want to think of an equivalent in the economy, it would be Google. Then as relationships get sorted out and become more interdependent and more locked into one another, niches are filled and so forth, what you do is you find that the system looks big or looks solid, but really it's often quite vulnerable. The example in the economy would be General Motors. The weakness of big things is usually in that consolidation phase. It means that when everything is linked together, you get the right combination of changes. Even a small change somewhere in a corner of the system can cascade and spiral out of control. A little like what we saw when Bear Stearns went down and then Merrill Lynch and, you know, AIG and on and on. In nature, it would be like a lightning strike or a match at the edge of a very large forest loaded with fuel. After that happens, you go through collapse. I don't think I have to tell your listeners about collapse. They're experiencing it right now. But then there's a regeneration phase, and I think that's what we have to focus on. A lot of energy is released during the collapse phase, and that leads to regeneration.
Well, you talk about in your article, you sort of give a forest as an example.
Right. A lot of the work that was done in ecology on this was done by a guy named Fritz Hollings, who studied forests and the different cycles and phases they go through. Now, I must say that there's also a climax ecosystem where things are in balance, and there is, you know, there's a lot of give and take, and the system's sort of open and pulling in energy, and still fairly creative. But that seems to be more the exception to the rule, especially in the human realm. I mean, I think we're all familiar with the fact that civilizations come and go, and empires come and go, and I guess even GM comes and goes.
Well, you know, talking about collapse, there's a very interesting writer. His name is John Michael Greer, and he lives in Ashland, Oregon. He's also, besides being an ecology writer and environmental writer, he's the arch druid. He's a real official druid.
Mm.
But he points out that even collapse takes a long time. You know, he writes a lot of peak oil websites. And he points out that even when the Mayan civilization collapsed, it took over 100 years before that to happen. It's not an overnight thing.
Well, and of course, we're talking on a historical scale where, 100 years, which sounds like a very long time, in the scale of history is actually not that long.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if you look at writers like Jared Diamond, one of the things that he found in his research is that big systems, when they go down, tend to go down more like an avalanche than slow erosion. Now, of course, you can probably see signs that things have been falling apart for a long time, and it may continue for a long time, but there usually is some event that feels pretty much like a crisis, and I think we are hopefully, at the end of experiencing that since September.
Well, you know, if you look at it historically, I would think that the, when Europe conquered the Americas, you know, which took several hundred years, and that was that was sort of the growth phase of capitalism. That's what kickstarted capitalism. And, you talk about there were all sorts of opportunities. It was kind of open for anybody. Anybody could come to these shores. And if they worked hard, they had a decent chance of making a good living. And this also, this sort of perpetual growth was really got into people's heads. And with perpetual growth, you have this whole credit economy. You know, if you borrow money and the economy's growing, you can always pay it back. But maybe that whole historic cycle is coming to an end.
You know, I recently picked up a book that I'd highly recommend that was written way back, I think, in 1980 by a guy named William Catton, and it's called Overshoot. And it gives a great description of what you just described, which was the fact that at some point we discovered we had a whole second hemisphere we could fill up, and also we discovered how to tap into all sorts of reserves like oil and coal and so forth, tap aquifers that we couldn't get to before. And we started, you might say, borrowing from or stealing from the future while we were expanding across the second hemisphere. And it was a period of rapid growth, and I think that became our ideology, almost our religion. Growth is good. We have a GDP, which is supposed to be the primary measure of how well we're doing, and it really is crazy. I mean, you know, if a busload of little girls goes off a cliff, then you have to build new bus, and you have a lot of lawyers who get paid and funeral homes and so forth, and it all adds to the GDP.
Right.
So the GDP says actually nothing about whether we're happier or better or people or there's more justice or anything else that we supposedly value. It's just sort of a dumb measure of growth.
Well, so what happens if growth stops? I mean, if growth stops, what happens to credit and lending and all that kind of stuff?
I don't know, and I'll tell you it's very hard to imagine. Let's take your historical example back one step. During the medieval period, or most of the history of Europe, it was actually prohibited to loan and borrow money. That was called usury.
Mm-hmm.
And supposedly only God could make a profit off of time, and so people couldn't do that. And they were tied to the land in a very rigid social hierarchy of, you know, nobles and knights and serfs and so forth. People did what their fathers did. If you were a shoemaker, that's what your dad was a shoemaker, you were a shoemaker. Those people probably could not have imagined that era of mercantile capitalism that you described, where there was great geographic mobility, social mobility, You weren't tied to the land. There was such a thing as citizenship eventually, and lots of lending going on all the time. I think from our perspective, it's just as hard to see over the horizon and say, what would a world be like where we don't depend on constant growth? We are not dependent on constant loaning of money, financial instruments, and so forth, where maybe the priority is health rather than wealth.
Well, I guess it would be if the money system collapses, then we're left with sort of land and labor.
And I would imagine there'll be a lot more people growing food.
Yes, well, that's right. And global trade. Well, global trade seems to be shrinking very rapidly right now, even before peak oil ever. Well, no one knows when peak oil is going to happen. But so we'd have a situation where people are on the land. They have to feed themselves. They have to organize themselves without a lot of, lending. It's just sort of, I don't know, barter economy, local currencies. You know, we do have a local currency right up the river in Hood River here.
Yeah, it's probably not kosher to go on the radio and tell people to read somebody else's article. I want everybody to go to Tom Dispatch. It's mm-hmm. a wonderful website.
It is.
But in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine, this being the Earth Day week, it was the green issue, and they featured a story called The End. It's right here. The End is Near, and then in parentheses it said, Yay! And it's about transition towns, relocalization, all the different efforts that people are making locally to what they say is to make sure that during this collapse phase they have an elegant descent from the top. And they're planning for local food, local energy, local currency, local health, healthcare, and I think more importantly what they're doing without the help from the feds or from big banks or from all the usual suspects is that they're rebuilding a democratic culture and talking to each other.
Well, we have a transition group right here in Portland. They've been very active in the last year or so. They're part of the Peak Oil Group, which meets every Wednesday at St. Francis Church, which is in our neighborhood. And it's almost like a revival atmosphere, you know. I guess the idea originated with a fellow in England.
Yeah, I think his name is Rob. Rob Hobson?
Mm-hmm. Something like that. Right.
Yeah. All right. Well, I can speak to you as a person who spent a lot of years on the front line of environmental issues, trying to make an immediate difference, make polluters accountable, and so forth. And I dealt with things like chemical weapons incineration, dioxin emissions, nuclear waste disposal, and so forth. And I learned that there's sort of a bottom line. The health and vitality of your natural and physical environment is directly related to the health and vitality of your civic environment. And so even if these folks don't accomplish the content of what they're trying, you know, a farmer's market, a community garden, a local power grid, whatever, just by building that democratic culture and reinvigorating their civic environment, they'll be prepared to be to face whatever comes up. We talk about sustainability a lot. I think we also ought to talk about resilience.
Yeah, well, that is a big word with the transition people. And it's like when you talk in your article, you know, the regeneration phase of this these cycles where, you know, sort of the big trees have crashed and it's sort of that leaves room for all these little, for a new kind of forest, smaller trees springing up everywhere. And that sort of would be the hopeful aspect of this. Although you also raise the possibility that the dead forest may turn into a desert where nothing happens. But what about the regeneration?
Well, let's hit that theme there. When you go through the regeneration phase, you don't always have renewal. I mean, you don't always go back to where you want. Mm-hmm. In a forest, for example, hopefully a fire, for example, would reset the successional clock, and then you'd go back to the whole cycle that brings you a mature forest again. There are times, however, when you go from one phase to the next and you get into an entirely different regime and you can't come back. If you have the right combination of drought, out here we have a problem with drought and then beetle kill forests, and then you have these enormous forest fires that aren't like the natural cycle. And, that could set the stage for something entirely different. So it's very, very important to look at those thresholds and see them coming and understand when you're crossing boundaries. I think that we realize we've already gone through quite a few tipping points with the climate, and there's probably no way back to the climate that we enjoyed when we were kids.
We are talking with Chip Ward, who's an environmental writer, and he has a very interesting article in the Tom Dispatch called Too Big to Fail. Let's talk a little bit about the relation of the economy with nature, because, you hear some of these economic gurus saying, well, the economy works in such a way that it achieves the best result, for the system as a whole. But they don't seem to understand that the economy is not a system in itself. It's a sort of a subsystem of nature.
Well, I think that the problem that humankind has been dealing with for most of its history has been scarcity. And we've also had some pretty amazing technology. And I think we now live with this myth that we're exempt. We're a special case. We're not limited. And that we can always escape scarcity or deal with resource scarcity through our technology and our wit. I don't think that's true. I mean, nature really is bounded. There are only so many aquifers. There's only so much fertile soil. There's only so much fish stock, and so on. If you overload the carrying capacity of your environment, which we've done, at some point there's going to be a bill to pay. Things sort of balance, go the other way. So our economy really is out of sync with natural rules and limits. And I think that there's lots of talk now about having an economy that is no growth and that meets people's needs as well as it can while not trashing the environment so that there's a bigger bill to pay down the road.
There's some other books that deal with this. Well, one of the most famous ones is E.F. Schumacher, Small is Beautiful.
Right.
And it was sort of subtitled, An Economy as If People Mattered, which has sort of become a classic. And then there was an earlier writer. His name is Leopold Kohr, K-O-H-R. And he wrote The Breakdown of Nations.
I'm not familiar with Leopold Kohr's book, but E.F. Schumacher is one that's a book that I read and was on my bookcase has been there for, 30 years, I guess. I think Schumacher's critique, though, was a little bit more from a psychological or even a religious perspective. He felt that bigness turned people into workers and consumers and sort of hollowed them out, robbed them of their creativity and also, you might say, distorted their identity. And that is certainly true, and you could make that argument today. I was just up north in Salt Lake. There's a whole area on the west end of Salt Lake that used to be rolling farmland, and I'm always shocked when I go back there to find out how sprawl has happened. My daughter lives in a condo complex, which is on in the middle of two other condo complexes. And when you go there on the weekend, there's all these rental trucks because people don't really live there. It's transitional. And they don't get to know each other. They don't function as a community. And it really is a way of warehousing people. And then you say, well, obviously they're being warehoused for their labor. That's needed, though less so today than it was a few months ago. But also there's malls surrounding there. I mean, it's just big box stores everywhere. And I think that to try to compensate for the lack of meaning in that kind of life, people are, they turn into consumers. They go into Walmart and try to compensate. So Schumacher's critique is about that kind of thing, and I think it's very, very important. If we knew as much about the environment and ecology in Schumacher's day, I think he would have had a whole other set of arguments to make.
Where do people in Salt Lake City? I've been there. It's a beautiful place, but I never noticed much agriculture going on. Where does the food come from?
Well, our food, like food everywhere, in most parts of the country, unless you live in someplace like Florida or California, it comes from very far away. And, like all other parts of the country, we had a lot more locally produced food 30, 40, 50 years ago than we do today. I read another article for Time Dispatch trying to redefine homeland security into homegrown security and talk about issues like local food and so forth. If you look back in the February archives at Time Dispatch, it's back there. We don't have a lot of local food. We're getting more of it. Where I live right now, we have an organic farmer who's 30 miles down the road, which is not very far in this part of the world. And he's struggling. And boy, I want to tell you, the community has absolutely responded. He had a flood last year that took out one of his fields, and the community had a fundraiser. We want local food. It's delicious. It's organic. It's clean. And we feel that if there's an earthquake and somehow we're cut off from Richfield, which is the grocery store 65 miles away, we want to make sure that that guy down the road is producing food.
Oh, yes. Leopold Kohr is an interesting writer. He's an Austrian socialist. I think he actually fought in the Spanish Civil War. And this book was written around 1940. And his idea is basically very simple, is that there's sort of an optimum size for a democratic nation. And he sort of put that optimum size, kind of like Austria, you know, that when nations get too big, and he mentioned the United States and China, Soviet Union, that when nations get too big, they really don't function very well as democracies.
Well, you know, we had a guy out here who John Wesley Powell, who explored the Colorado River and much of the West, and concluded that the best way to organize the West, especially the arid lands of the West where I live, would be around watersheds, and that would just make sense. People would take responsibility for their watershed. They would understand its needs and its limits, and they would be wise in its use. But that model didn't happen.
So what do you think the regeneration would look like? Where do we go if the economy does collapse, all the giant trees fall down in our economy? What's the hopeful scenario?
Well, I have a friend who's a wonderful writer, Rebecca Solnit, and she has a book that will be coming out this year, and she's been going around and looking at places where this has sort of already happened. Rebecca spent a lot of time in Detroit. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Detroit, we know, is sort of an urban basket case. Far, far more people have moved out. More buildings have been torn down than are being built. It's impoverished and so forth. Apparently, large sections of the city are going back to nature. And people are actually homesteading within the city, buying up houses and farming and producing their own food and finding each other in the process and building small communities. So I know that there will be chaos if things break down and this slow unraveling continues. But I think a lot of people will find that there's other meaningful ways to live, and that our things are not the only measure of how well we're doing and how happy we can be.
Yeah, I heard about Detroit, the farming. I guess you can actually buy a house for less than $100 if you're willing to fix it up and stay there. And it's... It makes you think a little bit like when the Roman Empire collapsed. People, Rome still existed, you know, and there were people, a lot of people left, but there were people who just lived there among the ruined buildings, and they farmed, and they, the people didn't vanish, even though the civilization kind of faded out.
Well, in my neighborhood, we have lots of abandoned ancient Indian ruins, mm-hmm. places like Mesa Verde and Chaco Canyon, and really thousands of smaller sites throughout Utah. I've got them probably within 2 miles of my house. And, it's fascinating to look through those kinds of things and say, well, geez, you know, what happened? Where did they go? What was their story? I don't think you have to go too far to find out. There's the Hopis are over on the Mesa. The Zuni are there. The Pueblo groups are along the Rio Grande. Hopefully, people learn from their lessons and they regather, regroup, and regenerate.
Okay, well, that's a hopeful note to end. Now, we've been talking with Chip Ward, who's an environmental writer and living in Utah, and has written an article for the Tom Dispatch, which I recommend to everybody. It's a really great website. And this article is called Too Big to Fail. So thanks a lot for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And let me talk about a couple things happening tomorrow. The two programs related to what we've talked about. On Alternative Radio at 9, the speaker is David Corton, author of The Great Turning, An Agenda for a New Economy. And then at 11 tomorrow on the Recovery Zone, Stephanie Potter will speak with Colin Ferguson, who's from Cascadia Commons Community, about his efforts to establish an open local exchange trading system, kind of a what do we do when the money supply crashes. So that is all tomorrow, and stay tuned. Coming up right after this will be Air Cascadia, and so thank you very much for being with us.